Welcome, Coastline family, and any visitors online that are joining us tonight. We are doing our monthly Signs of the Times discussion. And if you might have noticed, I'm all up here by my lonesome. Nobody else wanted to talk with me this month. No, actually, I just, for this month, kind of praying into it, felt led to, whereas with the last couple months, we've kind of focused on individual topics having to do with the end times. Tonight, I felt led to more focus on doing just kind of a look at current events, like as many as I can kind of fit in to hopefully an hour. I really don't want to talk for an hour and a half all by myself, but as many current events as I can get that potentially could have to do with Bible prophecy that we see in Scripture. And so I figured I could kind of handle that on my own, just kind of going through those different events and looking at them and seeing what scriptures they might pertain to. So I'm glad you could join us tonight. Let's go ahead and start out by praying for the Lord's blessing on tonight's message, and then we will get into it. Dear Heavenly Father, Lord God, thank you so much for this opportunity to open up your word, look at these things that, or be reminded of these things that you told us would happen as your return grew near. As we're going to look at first and foremost, you said it would be important that we understood these things because it would produce in us a readiness and an excitement for your soon return, which would affect the way that we live for you. And so we want to listen to your word in being people that are diligent to look all of it or know all of it, but understand the season that we're living in as we see maybe not these exact prophetic events happening, but we see the signs leading up to them. We see some of these things happening that are leading to your return being near in our lives. And so that's exciting because we want to be with you. We want our salvation to be completed as we're with you and we never leave your side again. And so, Father, just as we study these things, I pray you'd encourage us in this and you'd help us to an even greater degree live with that expectancy and that readiness of your soon return in our lives. Pray for your blessing on your word. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. Well, the first thing I wanted to talk about tonight, just even before we get into these current events, is just kind of simply kind of give us a reminder on why it's important to understand biblical prophecy and the effect it would have on our lives. Basically, Jesus is the one that told us that. He didn't just kind of like tell his disciples a bunch of different things that are going to happen as soon as his return draws near and say, okay, you can just do what you want with this information. No, he actually told them why it was important that they understood these things. And so the passage I'm in is Matthew 24, and I'm going to start in verse 32. And this is at the end of, or at the beginning of this chapter, Jesus' disciples ask him, like, what things are going to happen, you know, when you return or leading up to your return? What are these things Jesus pointed out something specific as far as the temple being destroyed? And so they were like, what's going to happen leading up to this, all right? And so he says in verse 32, from the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. It's Matthew 24, starting verse 32. Verse 33 says, So also when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly, I will say to you, this generation will not pass away, us being a part of that generation, until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. No one knows the day and the hour, but concerning that day, an hour, no one knows, basically Jesus' second coming, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. So basically what he's saying there is nobody knows the exact time when Jesus is going to return. So if anyone's ever telling you or spouting out dates or, you know, like this is when it's going to happen, that should be a red flag because that's actually very contrary to what Jesus tells us in his word. But he did say that you'd recognize the season, all right? So he uses that example of a fig tree. Just like you can tell when it's a certain season, when certain things are happening with that fig tree, when you see this is after he pointed out some things to them that would happen leading up to his return. He says, when you see these things happen, then you'll know that you're in that season. And he goes on to tell us in verse 37, for as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark. And they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. So the idea there is just like in Noah's day, where other than Noah and his family, everyone else pretty much did not expect the flood. They weren't ready. They weren't looking for it, if you will. They were kind of caught off guard. He's saying that's how it's going to be like when Jesus' return. It's going to be unexpected by the people in the world, if you will. And it goes on in verse 40, and it says, then two men will be in the field, and one will be taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one left. So here he's speaking specifically to his church, I believe, talking about the rapture of the church, an event that happens preceding. It's another event that precedes his second coming. And basically, it's kind of the beginning of the end, because when the rapture happens, when the church is caught up, that's the beginning of the last 7 years or the 7 year tribulation period. But before Jesus Christ comes to rule and reign on this earth for 1,000 years. Basically, it marks the beginning of the Antichrist kind of coming on the scene or making himself known and kind of establishing his government and at the midpoint of that, demanding to be worshipped as God, and then God's judgment and wrath just raining down on an unrepentant world that has chance after chance to turn to him and refuses to. So it goes on in verse 32 and it says, therefore, or Jesus says, basically, because of everything I've told you, he says, you should stay awake. Basically, our tendency, if you haven't noticed this, is to kind of be complacent or just not stay awake, if you will, not be ready, not be alert. And he's saying, because of these things, because when you recognize the season, when you see these things happening, I told you, it should produce a readiness, an alertness. You should be awake. And he goes on, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming, but know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. So Jesus basically says the reason that it's important to understand the events surrounding his second coming, what he's explained to the disciples here, is because it would produce a watchfulness, like they looking for these things, and knowing that basically at any moment it could be their last moment here on this earth to serve the Lord, or basically when you know that he's coming back, we know that it could be any moment where he's coming back, because we see these things happening around us. That should produce a sense of urgency in your life, like understanding that, wow, this could be the last opportunity I actually have to tell this family member or this friend that I dearly care about Jesus, and save them from, or give God a chance to save them from spending eternity in hell separated from him. Or this could be the last moment that I have to be faithful with this thing the Lord's given me, with my family or with my job or with this ministry, and you know, go to heaven, you know, in with those rewards for being faithful, those crowns that I'm going to enjoy for all eternity. Like that, I could run out of time at any second. Like that's the way we're supposed to live our lives. And I like that example of how he uses the application of a thief breaking into a house, because here's the reality, guys. If somebody came and told you, or if somebody came and told me that somebody is going to break into your house within the next whatever time period, they could say he's going to break into your house within the next couple of days, or he could say that person's going to break into your house within the next 10 years. Either way, it would not affect the way that I react to that. Like basically, if I knew somebody's going to break into my house, whether it be sometime in the next 10 years or sometime in the next 10 days, I'm still going to have a security system and make sure it's working. I'm still going to have my firearms as close to me as possible so I'm ready to protect my family if I need to. Like, it's not going to change. Like, I'm not going to just take, oh, wow, well, he said it could be sometime in the next 10 years, so I don't really care. I can take a wait-and-see approach. No, that's not how I'm going to react, all right? And so, like, that's what he's saying. Don't be like that. Don't be like a wait and see approach or procrastinate. Like, he's like, you need to be ready, like, at any moment, all right? And the reason for it is because he doesn't want you to miss out on the abundant life. Like, when we're living with this, not complacency, but like this attentiveness, this readiness, this desire to, like, man, spend every moment like it's my last living for Jesus, that's where you're going to press in and follow him and stay close to him and abide. And that's where he's going to be able to produce the most fruit in your life and through your life. And you're going to be blessed. I mean, because that's what results from Jesus having his way in your life. You will be blessed. He doesn't want you to miss out on that blessing. So that's the important reason. That's why we want to make sure that we understand biblical prophecy and that we're paying attention to the things happening in the world around us so that we see these things starting to fall into place, and it produces that in us, that readiness and that excitement, all right? So what we're going to do now, since we know the reason why it's important to understand the stuff we're going to be talking about and how it pertains to Scripture, we're going to just go through some current events in the world, some of the stuff you might already know or you've heard about. And I'm going to, again, talk about how it may relate to Bible prophecy. Because here's the thing. A lot of the prophecy that's going to happen still it hasn't happened yet, or it's not going to happen until the tribulation, when I don't believe we're going to be here as a church. But it's future. It's going to happen later. And so I'm not necessarily talking about these future events that I'm going to point out in Scripture today as happening right now. But a lot of them are so drastic, they're so crazy, that they can't just happen. There has to be a preparation. There has to be things falling in place and in order way before you ever get to these things, to pave the way, if you will, for them to happen. And a lot of that stuff is happening right now. Now, some of the things that Jesus said, you know, we'll read some of them in Matthew 24. You're going to see these things start to happen. He describes them as birth pains, which for the ladies, they know that, you know, that birth pains start out gradual and then they just intensify. So some of these things are happening now, gradually increasing, and we're seeing that increasing in front of us. And so that lets us know that we're getting closer to Jesus's return. So the first thing I want to talk about is the nation of Israel. Obviously, there's a whole lot about the nation of Israel, but God's people from the Old Testament, and there's unfulfilled prophecy about Israel, prophecy that was made about them, that's spoken of in the Old and New Testament, that has not been fulfilled yet. And one such event is the attack of them, detailed in Ezekiel 38:39, by a coalition of countries. You might have tuned into the prophecy update or the Signs of the Times discussion we had about the nation of Israel a while back. If not, you can find that on YouTube or Facebook. But we talked about specifically this as being one of the major prophetic events that people are kind of being watchful for, because the way that Scripture describes it, it's something that's going to happen probably either right before or after the rapture of the church. Some people think it's going to happen sometime during the tribulation period. We can't know for sure the timing, but it's going to be something that it's something we know that has not happened yet, because it's very specific about what's going to happen. And what Ezekiel 38 tells us is that this attack is going to be led by the land of Magog, which is back then, it's what is now present-day Russia, and that the other countries joining Russia in this attack against Israel are going to be Persia, which is present-day Iran, Kush, which is present-day Sudan, Put, which is present-day Libya, and then Gomer and Beth Targamah, which are basically both located in present-day Turkey. So those five areas, those five countries are going to be involved in this attack where they come specifically against Israel. And basically God has to intervene in a way where it's obviously him. and deliver Israel from this. But there's interesting stuff happening with those countries that are listed there, at least some of them, and their relations with Israel in recent days that I wanted to just kind of talk about. And most recently, that has to do with the most recent war that kind of broke out between Israel and the Palestinians, or more accurately, I should say, the terrorist organization Hamas, because basically they're the ones running things in the Gaza Strip, and actually they've infiltrated the West Bank as well, where the Palestinians live. So they were kind of in charge of the attacks that were coming against Israel, and Israel had to respond to. But it's worthy to note some of those countries that I mentioned, they're going to be part of that Ezekiel 38 attack, and their responses towards Israel, because what you're going to see is that, and if you know the history between these countries, they're increasingly growing more hostile towards Israel. The first article I have is from Al Jazeera, and this was printed on May 12th, 2021, so it wasn't that long ago, last month. And it says, Turkish President Erdogan, if you don't know, he's the leader of Turkey right now, has told Russian President Vladimir Putin that the international community should give Israel a strong and deterrent lesson over its conduct towards the Palestinians. Erdogan made the comment during a phone call with Putin on a phone conference amid escalating violence in occupied East Jerusalem in the Gaza Strip. Says Erdogan had late last year expressed a desire to see relations between Turkey and Israel improve after years of disagreement over Tel Aviv's occupation of the West Bank and its treatment of Palestinians. Turkey, which in 1949 became the first Muslim-majority country to recognize Israel, first broke off ties with Israel in 2010, and they restored them in 2016, but relations soured again in 2018. So it's interesting to see, though, like that souring, if you will, or those relations growing worse, continuing to grow worse. Basically, like him basically saying, I think he actually specifically said in here somewhere, He suggested to Putin that an international protection force be put in place to shield the Palestinians, put it around the Palestinian settlements or whatnot, like made up of like a coalition of like Turkey and Iran and Russia. So it's pretty crazy. None of that's happened yet. But having said that, you see this hostility increasing from one of those countries, basically, that is listed as one of the ones that will be attacking Israel in that prophecy. Now, one of the other countries, the one that's kind of leading the charge, if you will, Russia. Here's another article from Newsweek, a recent article from May, and it says Russian President Vladimir Putin called the escalating Israeli-Palestinian conflict a direct threat to Russia's security on Friday. During a meeting with the Russian Security Council, Putin said that the proximity of the violence in Jerusalem in the Gaza Strip to Russia directly affects his country's agenda on security. Here's a quote from him. He says, I would like to ask my colleagues to comment on the current situation in the Middle East. I mean, the escalated Palestinian-Israeli conflict. This is happening in the immediate vicinity of our borders and directly affects our security interest, Putin is quoted as saying. Now, that's really interesting if you know any type of geography, okay? Because you should know that Israel's borders are nowhere near Russia's borders. There's quite a few countries in between that. They're not in the immediate vicinity of Russia. And the reality is, for big bad Russia, I mean, one of the powerhouse nations with huge military, Israel's like a fly on the wall. It's like there's no direct threat. But what's interesting about this is that Ezekiel 39 or Ezekiel 38, when it's talking about the reasons why Russia comes against them, there's like an ulterior motive. There's something that they want. And so, you know, like what Putin's saying here really doesn't pass a straight face test, in that it would sound like, okay, this isn't the real reason. You know, what's the real reason behind, you know, like you kind of being aggressive and making these statements? It says in Ezekiel 38, 10 through 13, this is about Magog or about Russia. This is what the sovereign Lord says. At that time, evil thoughts will come to your mind. and you will devise a wicked scheme. You will say, Israel is an unprotected land filled with unwalled villages. I will march against her and destroy these people who live in such confidence. I will go to those formerly desolate cities that are now filled with people who have returned from exile in many nations, and I will capture vast amounts of plunder, for the people are rich with livestock and other possessions now. They think the whole world revolves around them. So basically it talks about Russia wanting to attack them for some sort of a spoil, or like some sort of economic thing that they can gain, you know, if you will. And people that know Israel, or maybe if you're familiar with it, they've got a whole lot of economic wealth for such a small country, and they've got a lot of natural minerals in the way of natural gas reserves, and even supposedly big oil reserves underneath some of their mountains and stuff. So who knows what it could be, but basically it's just interesting, again, to see that hostility increase. I saw you raise your hand. Stephen has a question. Do you have a question? Okay. No questions till the end, please. All right. So it's interesting, again, just to see that hostility increase, and even kind of some of those statements being made, like, okay, what's the real reason for this going on, all right? Now, in addition, the relationships between Turkey has also been souring between some of its NATO allies. If you guys weren't familiar, Turkey is like supposed to be on what we would call the good guys side, if you will, or like they're part of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which we're a part of, the UK, several European nations are a part of, in direct response to kind of having a protective alliance against like Russia and China and some of those other organizations. So Turkey's been a part of that for a number of years, but they've been threatening in recent years to basically pull out of it because of disagreements that they've had with the U.S. and other nations. And most recently, you guys might have heard of this, they got really upset at the United States because of the Biden administration's formal recognition of an incident that happened with them that they called genocide with the Armenians. Basically, this is from April 25th, 2021. It says, U.S. President Joe Biden's declaration that massacres of Armenians in the Ottoman Empire constituted genocide is simply outrageous, and Turkey will respond over coming months, Turkey's presidential spokesman said on Sunday. Biden broke on Saturday with decades of carefully calibrated White House comments over the 1915 killings, delighting Armenia, but further straining ties between Washington and Ankara, both members of the NATO military alliance. There will be a reaction of different forms and kinds and degrees in coming days and months, said Turkey's spokesman. So again, veiled threats, not really being specific, but saying, you know, there's going to be repercussions. Says for decades, measures recognizing the Armenian genocide stalled in the U.S. Congress, and most U.S. presidents have refrained from calling it that, held back by concerns about straining relations with Turkey. But those relations are already troubled. Washington imposed sanctions on Turkey over its purchase of Russian air defenses, while Ankara has been angered that the United States has armed Kurdish YPG fighters in Syria and not extradited a U.S.-based cleric Turkey accuses of orchestrating a coup in 2016. So their spokesman says, navigating those disputes will now be even harder. Everything that we conduct with the United States will be under the spell of this very unfortunate statement. So again, you see tensions rising with one of Israel's biggest allies in the United States, with Turkey, you know, one of these countries that's supposed to eventually be a part of this coalition that's going to attack them. So it's interesting, again, that this prophecy hasn't happened yet, but you see these things kind of falling into place leading up to it, that's kind of preparing a climate where something like this could happen at any time. Now, it's going to be interesting to watch some of the recent changes in leadership in the Middle East, specifically with Israel in Iran, if you guys have been following the news, to see how it's going to affect basically kind of the relationships in the area and kind of some of these hot topic issues. One of those hot topics right now is the development of nuclear weapons by Iran, Iran being one of those countries that a lot of other countries are fearful of, that they may be crazy enough to use a nuclear weapon, should they ever get one. Basically, you guys might have heard this before, but there's this idea of mutual destruction that is supposed to be or supposed to discourage countries from using nuclear weapons. Basically, the fact that if you shoot at me, I'm going to shoot at you, and we're both going to end up annihilated. So, you know, that's why you have like a major buildup, you know, of bigger countries like the United States and China and Russia. They have these nuclear arsenals that are huge because it's supposed to be a deterrent from ever having nuclear war. But then there's those countries that kind of don't have nuclear weapons because they make these threats that aren't veiled. They're in your face saying, if we ever get this, we're going to use this, all right? And Iran is one of those countries. And so it's going to be interesting, you know, to see with this new leadership what happens here. That if you guys have been following the news, the Trump administration had pulled out of a nuclear arms agreement in last year with Iran, mainly because Iran wasn't following it, and it really didn't accomplish the goal of preventing them from developing nuclear weapons. It just kind of limited what they could do, and they weren't really following even that. And so sanctions basically were imposed upon them in order to encourage them to a better agreement or get them to just, you know, simply make an effort to follow kind of what they agreed to be doing. And Israel, under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, supported that move because he didn't like that agreement either for those same reasons. And he was very proactive in his 15 years of leadership in making sure that Israel did whatever was necessary to prevent Iran from ever even getting to the point of developing nuclear weapons. And you can't really blame him for wanting to take that stance because Iran has been very vocal, its leadership has at least, that it is going to destroy Israel eventually. And you guys might have seen in one of my prophecy updates not that long ago that they had recently introduced a bill in their parliament that basically actually set a date to that goal. Like it was like by 2040, we're going to annihilate Israel, all right? So they're very vocal about it, okay? So as a result, you know, the previous leadership in Israel was very proactive. And you guys might have heard like of events over the last couple of years, like some malfunctions, attacks, whatever you call it, explosions on many of the Iranian nuclear facilities and it being attributed to Israel in some way or another. There was an article yesterday, June 23rd, on one of these most recent attacks. It says, the attack on Iranian nuclear site damaged centrifuge production facilities. It says the attempted attack on an Iranian nuclear site outside Tehran, that was reported on Wednesday, targeted a facility used in the construction of centrifuges needed to enrich uranium, Iranian opposition sources said. Despite official Iranian claims to the contrary, the strike caused damage to this facility, according to unsourced reports in Hebrew media on Wednesday evening. The attack was reportedly conducted with small drones. Iran did not identify who was behind the attack. It has accused Israel of conducting similar strikes on its nuclear facilities in recent years. According to official Iranian media, the target of Wednesday's strike was a facility that belongs to Iran's Atomic Energy Organization in the city of Karaj. Though Iran maintains that the Karaj facility is used for civilian purposes, it has been subjected to United Nations, European Union, and American sanctions since 2007 for being involved in Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile programs. The U.S. lifted those sanctions under the 2015 nuclear deal, but then reimposed them in 2018 when then-President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from the accord. The attempted sabotage appeared to be the latest in a series of attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities in recent months, many of which have been attributed to Israel. In April, Iran's underground Natanz nuclear facility experienced a mysterious explosion that damaged some of its centrifuges. Last July, unexplained fires struck the advanced centrifuge assembly plant at Natanz, which authorities later described as sabotage, and Iran now is rebuilding that facility deep inside a nearby mountain. Iran has also blamed Israel for the November killing of one of its scientists who began the country's military nuclear program decades earlier. And in a bombshell interview earlier this month, the former head of the Mossad spy agency, basically like Israel's version of CIA, all but confirmed that Israel was behind both the Natanz blasts and the killing of the Israeli scientists in charge of their nuclear program. More generally, that former leader in the Mossad agency said, "We say very clearly to Iran, we won't let you get nuclear weapons. What don't you understand?" And earlier this week, Iran's southern nuclear power plant was temporarily shut down over a technical fault. The country's atomic energy body said, the statement said the plant will be reconnected to the grid and the issue will be resolved in a few days, but didn't elaborate further. Wednesday's attack came as the U.S. and Iran, through intermediaries, were negotiating a mutual return to the 2015 nuclear deal known formally as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. When Trump abrogated the agreement in 2018, he put in place a crushing sanctions regimen, which prompted Iran to also abandon the accord a year later, enriching more uranium and at greater levels of purity than was permitted under the deal, as well as taking part in other forms of prescribed nuclear research. Israel staunchly opposes U.S. President Joe Biden's plan to re-enter that agreement, which he has said he's prepared to do provided Iran returns to compliance with the agreement. In an apparent effort to ramp up pressure during these negotiations, Iran in April boosted its uranium enrichment to 60% purity, bringing it closer to the 90% needed for full military use. And Iran has denied seeking to make nuclear weapons, but the International Atomic Energy Agency says that Iranian enrichment to those levels are only sought by countries to build a weapon. There's no other purpose for doing that. So it's interesting to see basically kind of this stuff going on behind the scenes. You see, again, one of these countries that is said to be a part of this coalition that's going to attack Israel. You see this kind of hostility growing. You see them kind of growing more bold in developing nuclear weapons that potentially could be used in any type of attack. And you see relations between the surrounding countries kind of souring. Now, one thing that's also interesting, too, because the Biden administration is trying to get back into this treaty with them that, you know, again, Israel and the former administration didn't like the treaty because they weren't following it, and it didn't prevent them completely from making nuclear weapons. It says here, if you guys didn't know, Iran recently elected a new president, if you will, or a new leader too. And that new leader, Ebrahim Raisi, on Monday ruled out a meeting with President Joe Biden in response to CNN called on the, this is from June 21st, called on the United States to return to the nuclear deal in his first international news conference since he won Iran's election over the weekend. Raisi said he would not meet with Biden even if both sides agreed on terms to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. On Saturday, the hardline the chief and staunch Western critic was declared the winner of a historically uncompetitive election in Iran. All of his serious rivals were barred from the race. Sounds really fair. Responding to a question from CNN on Monday's news conference in Tehran, the president-elect accused the U.S. and European Union of violating the deal and called on Biden to lift all sanctions before adding that the country's ballistic missile program was not up for negotiation. So basically, this new president looks as if he's not even willing to negotiate their development of nuclear weapons. Like, he's just going to keep on doing it. So, again, it's interesting, all of this happening, okay? Because, you know, again, we're kind of watchful and looking for this attack that's going to come against God's people where he's going to have to intervene. Now, what's also going to be interesting to see with this new leadership coming into place is their responses of some of the other hot topics in that region having to do with Israel. One of them being the Palestinian occupation in the West Bank, a separate Palestinian state, like a two-state solution, which has kind of been the talk of past negotiations between the Palestinians and Israelis. And then specifically in Jerusalem regarding occupation of the Temple Mount, which is currently occupied by Muslims under Jordanian custodianship, with Israeli security forces maintaining kind of control up there, trying to maintain peace. But why we're watching that occupation of the Temple Mount is because 2 Thessalonians and Daniel talk about the Antichrist when he comes on the scene at the beginning of the tribulation. There's going to be some sort of peace treaty formed with the Jewish people that he's going to form that's going to allow for the rebuilding of a third temple and Jewish worship to resume on the Temple Mount. And then 3.5 years into that agreement, he's going to break it. He's going to establish himself at the temple and demand he be worshipped as God, and the Jews are going to be forced to flee to the wilderness where God's going to protect 144,000 of them and save them through the tribulation. But again, any talk or consideration about changing the current status quo at the Temple Mount to allow both Muslim and Jewish worship to occur up there is definitely of interest because it may be the beginnings of that peace agreement. And here's the thing, the new government that was recently put together to unseat Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel after 15 years of being the prime minister there, it's very interesting because it is the most diverse of any coalition government. It's like a coalition of a bunch of different fractions, whereas we kind of have like Republican and Democrat, and there's some other tiny ones that really don't have a say because there's not enough people for them. They're made up of a bunch of different coalitions, and usually the person leading, like Netanyahu, he had a majority of people on his side that made up their, what they call their, I think it's, you pronounce it, yes it, or it's like their legislator. Nobody has a majority right now. Basically, in this article, it talks about Naftali Bennett. He's kind of the one that's leading right now, who leads a small right-wing party. Basically, that would be conservative, so it would be kind of pro-Jewish. And Yair Lapid, so he's the other half of this kind of person that puts coalition together, and he's a centrist leader of the Israeli opposition, so he's basically a moderate. He's kind of like, I'm not on the left, I'm not on the right, I'm just the guy in the middle that wants to make everyone happy. So they've joined forces to form a diverse coalition to unseat Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister. Spanning Israel's fractious political spectrum from left to right and relying on the support of a small Arab Islamist party, which is key because there's never been one involved before in kind of the government that's running things. The proposed coalition, dubbed the Change Government by supporters, could signal a profound shift for Israel. Its leaders have pledged to end the cycle of divisive politics in inconclusive elections. Mr. Bennett, whose party won 7 seats in parliament, is often described as further to the right than Mr. Netanyahu. While Mr. Netanyahu eroded the idea of a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Mr. Bennett is a religiously observant champion of Jewish settlement in the occupied West Bank, openly rejects the concept of a sovereign Palestinian state, and has advocated annexing West Bank territory. Still, though, the coalition will include several parties that disagree on both those issues. They have agreed to allow Mr. Bennett to become prime minister first. If the coalition deal holds, Mr. Bennett would be replaced for the second part of the 4-year term by the centrist, Mr. Lapid, who advocates for secular middle-class Israelis and whose party won 17 seats. By conceding the first turn in the rotation, Mr. Lapid, who has been branded as a dangerous leftist by his opponents on the right, smoothed the way for other right-wing politicians to join the new anti-Netanyahu alliance. In a measure of the plot twists and tumult behind the political turnaround, Mr. Bennett had pledged before the election not to enable a Lapid government of any kind or any government reliant on the Islamic party called ROM. The coalition would stand or fall on the cooperation between 8 parties with disparate ideologies and on many issues clashing agendas. In a televised address on Sunday night, Mr. Bennett said he was committed to fostering national unity. So basically what you see there is kind of a government made up of very diverse groups that all have differing opinions on some of these hot topic issues, that is saying they want to have unity and want to be at peace and not be divisive, all right? Which is very interesting. Again, This article talks about it in a little more detail. It says the next government, which will be led by the ultra-nationalist Naftali Bennett, has vowed to chart a new course aimed at healing the country's division and restoring a sense of normalcy. The coalition consists of 8 parties from across Israel's political spectrum, including a small Arab party that has made history by joining a government for the first time. All right. So again, if there was ever a government where you could see kind of this middle of the road approach where, okay, we want to make these guys happy and we want these guys happy, we want both Jews and Arabs to be able to worship on the Temple Mount, this would be a government that you could see something like that happening in eventually, especially when the next guy takes over in the next 2 years. Will that happen? We don't know. But having said that, it's just interesting. Again, there's some major changes there that would appear to, in a sense, kind of allow some of these things that we see in Bible prophecy spoken of to happen that really couldn't have happened before, or would appear not to have been able to happen. Kind of the way is being paved, if you will. All right. So it's interesting to watch what's happening in the Middle East. Second thing I want to talk about, the increase of lawlessness throughout the world, not only the United States. It should be pretty easy to see in the United States. There's definitely been an increase of lawlessness. Now, back in Matthew 24, Jesus said one of the things that would happen as we neared his return, he said, and because lawlessness, or some of your translations might say wickedness or sin, will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. And we've certainly seen that in our own country in this last year. Basically, violent crime has increased at a crazy rate in the United States among the rest of the world. This article from a couple days ago, 22nd, says from coast to coast, violent crime is rising in American cities. In just one recent weekend, more than 120 Americans were killed in shootings. It's a pattern across the country. Homicide rates in large cities rose more than 30% on average last year and climbed another 24% for the beginning of this year. This basically statistics from Fox News. This is interesting. Crime surges in cities across the U.S. These are some of the bigger cities that have the biggest crime rates. In Portland, it tops everything, all right? The biggest increase has been in Portland, our own local Portland, okay? I don't know if you've been to downtown in the last year, but it's pretty crazy. It looks like a war zone. The homicide rate, like people being killed, in the last year has increased 533%, all right? It hasn't just like doubled. It's like 533%, the amount of people being killed in the last year in Portland. Shootings have increased 126%. In Atlanta, 58% increase in homicides and a 40% increase in shootings. In Philadelphia, 37% increase in homicides, 27% increase in shootings. New York City, 13% increase in homicides, and 64% increase in shootings. Los Angeles, 22% increase in homicides and a 51% increase in shootings. So crazy increases in criminal activities, some of the worst criminal activities, shootings and killings of people. This article was about the global crime rate increase. It was from March 12th, 2021. It says the crime rate in 2021 is hitting worrying levels in many countries across the world. This uptick in crime began in 2020, a result of increasing job losses and poor performance of the overall economy. In a large number of countries around the world, criminal activity started rising steadily since early last year. Crime rates are directly related to the economic performance of any country. When there is scarcity of jobs, most people, especially the youth, are vulnerable to partaking in criminal activities to fund their lifestyle. This has definitely been the case across most of the world, including the USA, where masses of people are currently struggling with personal financial problems. There are many factors that are causing job loss and pushing up the crime rate. Though each country has been affected differently, there are common factors that have resulted in economic crises. They include economic meltdown, the halting of international travels because of COVID, extended lockdowns due to COVID, and then advancing technology, which leads to automation and job loss. So all over the world, increasing crime. Now, with that, the real scary thing is the legalization of things that were once illegal. Basically, the condoning of crime or the condoning of sin. Basically what Romans 1 talks about, man being given over to their sin because they just won't repent of it. And you see things that were once considered wrong and horrible and illegal with criminal penalties basically being made legal. It wasn't last year, I think, that Oregon passed a law that basically made hard drugs, like really bad drugs. I mean, years ago, marijuana got passed, and that's kind of working its way through the country. But we were the first state to actually allow a certain possession of things like cocaine and crack and make it legal, with the argument that it would make people not want to do it or be able to get help for it, which in my mind makes no sense whatsoever. But here's the latest thing that they're proposing. This is from June 3rd. Proposal would decriminalize prostitution in Oregon. Oregon's House Judiciary Committee held an informational hearing Thursday on a bill that would decriminalize prostitution in the state. House Bill 3088 would repeal the laws of prostitution, promoting prostitution, and commercial sexual solicitation. Listen to this. Barbara Brentz, sociology professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, talked about human trafficking and how decriminalization of sex work could help. Forced cohesion or sex trafficking is relatively rare. So I think statistics would say that's not true. But it's bad when it happens. But the evidence is really clear that arresting sex workers or their clients does not help. In fact, it increases risk and it may push sex workers by choice into a trafficking situation. So make it all legal and then it will all go away is basically what she's advocating there, which has never worked in the past. I don't know why it would work now, but it's interesting. You know, again, one of the reasons lawlessness is increasing is because we're basically making it legal and okay, saying it's okay to do it. Now, the other interesting thing is, and you guys have known this because this has been a hot topic throughout the year, these efforts to defund the police or basically take away the measures we have in place to basically counteract criminal activity, or by taking away their resources or taking away their ability to actually enforce the law, so as to force them basically to quit their jobs or resign. Basically, this just happened in Portland recently. You probably heard Portland Police Association leader explains why all members of Portland Police Riot Squad resigned. Basically, the whole entire Riot Squad, the response team that was made up of police that volunteered to be a part of that, resigned because they effectively said they couldn't do their job anymore because they had no support by the higher-ups. It's an interesting article, though. There's some things that I learned in it that I didn't know. Portland Police Association Executive Director Daryl Turner argued on Fox News Live Sunday that elected officials encouraged and enabled some of the violence that was taking place over the more than 150 nights of riots in Portland, explaining part of the reason why all 50 members of the Portland Police Riot Squad, known as the Rapid Response Team, resigned. All of the members of the Portland Police Bureau's highly trained Rapid Response Unit, which had responded to riots, resigned last week after the recent indictment of an officer for allegedly assaulting a photographer during an overnight riot last summer. On Tuesday, the Multnomah County Grand Jury charged the officer with one count of fourth-degree assault related to an incident on October 18th. That night, according to Portland Police Association, about 200 demonstrators, many equipped with tactical helmets, face coverings, and armed with a variety of weapons, but for a peaceful protest, mind you. I shouldn't say that. That's the rhetoric coming from some people. Armed with a variety of weapons, descended on the Multnomah building in southeast Portland. Multiple dumpsters were set on fire. Buildings were defaced and windows were broken. A riot was declared at the planned event after someone from the crowd launched a Molotov cocktail into the building and set it ablaze. After nearly 75 consecutive nights of violence, destruction, and mayhem, a small group of the riot response team officers, including this officer that was charged and found guilty, were again tasked with dealing with the riot. Per the command staff orders, the officers cleared the rioters from the area to allow the fire department to extinguish the blaze, but the rioters were not satisfied. According to the union, rioters regrouped and began marching back toward the building. As the rapid response team was working to clear the area, the officer was forcefully knocked to the ground, the one that was charged. And officers deployed pepper spray and less lethal munitions as the ground as the crowd grew more aggressive. Several rioters interfered with an officer attempting to place one person under arrest. The riot control officers, including the officer that had been charged, used their police bureau issued batons to try and stop the crowd's criminal activity. The union's description of the events continued. Per his training, and in response to the active aggression of a rioter interfering with a lawful arrest, the officer in question used baton pushes to move a rioter out of the area. An activist and photographer fell to the ground. Cell phone video showing the officer strike the person in the head from behind quickly circulated on social media, but the union said the blow to the head was an accident on the officer's part, and he used the lowest level of baton force. Reasonably believing that this protester was getting back up to reengage in her unlawful activities, the officer employed one last baton push to try to keep her on the ground, which accidentally struck the head. The location of the officer's last baton push was accidental, not criminal. He faced a violent and chaotic, rapidly evolving situation, and he used the lowest level of force, a push, not a strike or jab, to remove the person from the area. He said the Portland Police Association, which represents the rapid response team members, sent a letter to the city of Portland in October stating all the issues and problems and concerns that they had based on what happened over 150 days during the unprecedented sustained violence in the city of Portland. He stressed that our rapid response team, along with others from the police bureau, came out every night, stood the line with Molotov cocktails, urine, feces, rocks, bottles, everything else thrown at them. Turner added the families of the officers. Many of them were threatened. We had multiple assaults during the riots and also multiple assaults of police officers during the same riots. And he said the district attorney who indicted our officer declined 80% of the crimes committed during those riots. The Multnomah County District Attorney, which covers Portland, said of the 1,108 criminal civil unrest cases that were referred to them, they rejected 891 of them. Turner also stressed on Sunday that he does not believe the city of Portland supported the police department during the riots and instead actually encouraged and enabled some of the violence that was going on during those 150-plus nights. The residents and the business owners of the city of Portland have a hopeless feeling right now with what's gone on, he said, noting that the police department is understaffed and has been defunded. Our district attorney's continuing not to prosecute cases of crimes being committed during these riots. And the big thing is our city council refuses to allow us to have body cameras which would show the whole event, the total event. Regarding the officer that was indicted, only a snapshot of the event was captured because officers do not have body cameras, he said. We're one of the largest cities in the country whose police agency doesn't have body cameras, Turner said. Our city council refuses to do it. He argued that it's not a budgetary issue, but rather that they're afraid that the body cameras will show the false narrative being neutralized and the fact that we don't have a brutal police force. So it's interesting. Again, this was on mainstream from Fox News, this article about, you know, what went down. And what you're seeing is this happening all over the country. Like, basically, not only are police forces being defunded, but they're actually, they're not, since they're not being able to do their job, they're having to retire, they're having to quit because they don't have the support to do what they've previously been trained to do in these situations and actually uphold the law. So, again, obviously, if you take away the one force that we have out there to maintain order, it's going to allow for the increase of lawlessness, and that's what you see happening in the country nowadays. So, again, interesting stuff to watch, this increase of lawlessness, another thing that Jesus said would increase as we grew nearer to his return, and you see that kind of happening out there. All right, third thing, the Euphrates River drying up. Now, if you guys are prophecy buffs or you followed our study through the book of Revelation, something should spark your mind there because there's actually a specific reference to the Euphrates River drying up in Revelation chapter 16, verse 12. This being the what we call the bull wrath, where the angels are pulling out the bulls of God's wrath. And it's right leading up to the Battle of Armageddon at the end of the tribulation period where Jesus comes back, defeats the Antichrist in this army of people in the world that have come against him, and he establishes his rule and reign on here on earth. But it says in Revelation 16:12, then the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great Euphrates River, and it dried up so that the kings from the east could march their armies toward the west without hindrance. So What's interesting is over the last year, these pictures started circulating in articles about this catastrophic decline of the Euphrates River water level. This article is from May 6th, and it says, since the beginning of May, catastrophic scenes of tremendous decline in water level of Euphrates, the longest river of Western Asia, became a meme on social media platforms under hashtag the Euphrates decline. Syrians posted photos of the water level of the river showing how parts in along the river inside the Syrian lands dried up. The Euphrates runs from Turkey to Syria and then to Iraq until it joins the Tigris in Iraq. The Syrian regime accused Turkey of depriving Syrians of their water share of the Euphrates River, saying electricity production at the Euphrates dam stopped because the water is so low, and water level in Lake Al-Assad, the Syrian state-owned new agency Sana reported on Wednesday. Over the past 10 days, Turkey reduced the water flow to Syria from 500 to 200 cubic meters per second, suspending electricity production at the Euphrates dam, and led to a decrease in the irrigation and drinking water, besides a remarkable depletion of Lake Assad. Hundreds of thousands of civilians living in the Euphrates basin in the city of Al-Jazeera are vulnerable to a humanitarian catastrophe. So, interesting. Do I think this is the bull wrath? No, because that happens towards the end of the tribulation, so towards the end of the 7 years. But again, the Euphrates River is a big river. It's something that nobody thought could ever be dried up, you know. But here we're seeing Turkey's kind of, you know, interfering here or whatnot for whatever reason, and they're actually controlling it, and it is like a fraction of what it used to be. So it's an interesting thing. Shows how it might be dried up in the future, if you will. All right, so the next thing, rumors of war, earthquakes, and famines. Again, in Matthew 24, Jesus says in Matthew 24:6-8, and you will hear of wars and threats of wars, but don't panic. Yes, these things must take place, but the end won't follow immediately. Nation will go to war against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in many parts of the world. But all this is only the first of the birth pains with more to come. Now, in addition to the recent war with Hamas and Israel and these nuclear weapons being developed by Iran, which I've already talked about, what you're seeing in the world right now is a lot of posturing by the kind of big countries with the big militaries. And it's interesting because, you know, like what Jesus says here is that there will be wars and rumors of wars. He compares them to birth pains. Like he says, these things aren't going to take place immediately. But the idea there is that because, you know, a lot of people say, well, we've had wars, we've had earthquakes, we've had famines going on for centuries. And that's true. But what he says is you're going to see these things happening. And like birth pains, they're going to escalate and they're going to get worse and they're going to get more frequent. And that's what you've seen happening as history goes on. You see that happening. And so you see it happening to a great degree today. Again, going back to these bigger countries that are kind of challenging each other in a way without actually, you know, firing any weapons. Here's an article from the 23rd. So this is from yesterday. Russia deploys warships, submarines off the coast of Hawaii in a massive display of power. Russia has deployed a fleet of warships, submarines, and support vessels to a Pacific location just 35 nautical miles off the coast of Hawaii, the UK Daily Mail reported Tuesday. Flanked by fighter jets, as it carried out military exercises, the Russian fleet completed practice maneuvers for sinking an aircraft carrier. Russia's defense ministry has stated it has a fleet positioned 300 miles off the coast of Hawaii. But unconfirmed satellite images from June 19th show the vessels are actually just 40 miles away. Twice this month already, on the 14th and 18th of June, the U.S. has had to scramble F-22 Raptor stealth fighter jets in response to Russian bomber activity off the coast of Hawaii. The Russian jets did not enter the U.S. air defense identification zone on either occasion and were not intercepted. The U.S. Defense Ministry is keeping a careful eye on the situation. U.S. Indo-Pacific Command is monitoring the Russian vessels operating in international waters in the Western Pacific, U.S. Indo-Pacific Command spokesman said. So, interesting, like just kind of intentional provocation is what it seems to be, like seeing, you know, how far you can push the buttons before something happens, or basically showing we're not afraid of you kind of stuff. Also, this is from yesterday. Russia says it chases British destroyer out of Crimea waters with warning shots and bombs. Russia said on Wednesday it had fired warning shots and dropped bombs in the path of a British warship to chase it out of waters, Moscow claims, in the Black Sea off the coast of the Crimea Peninsula. Britain rejected Russia's account of the incident, saying it didn't believe any shots fired were a pre-announced Russian gunnery, or it believed any shots fired were a pre-announced Russian gunnery exercise, and that no bombs had been dropped. But it confirmed that its destroyer, the HMS Defender, had sailed through what is described as waters belonging to the UK. The ship was conducting an innocent passage through Ukrainian territorial waters in accordance with international law, according to their Ministry of Defense. Military experts said that whether or not the details of the Russian or British accounts were accurate, the incident appeared to represent an escalation in confrontation between the West and Russia over disputed sea lanes. Russia's foreign ministry called the passage of the British warship through the area an act of blatant provocation and said it would summon the British ambassador over the incident. Russia seized and annexed the Crimea Peninsula from the Ukraine in 2004. Peninsula's coast to be Russian waters. Western countries deem the Crimea part of the Ukraine and reject Russia's claim to seize around it. Western countries are conducting naval exercises this week in the Black Sea, known as Sea Breeze. So in the very same area, hours before the incident, Russia's embassy in Washington had called on the United States and its allies to cancel them, but they're still going on. So again, another part of the world, same type of thing, world powers just kind of pushing each other's buttons. Here's another recent article involving China in kind of the same type of thing. It says Joe Biden keeps up pressure on China as U.S. Navy warship passes Taiwan Strait. Chinese military has protested the presence of the latest U.S. Navy destroyer in the Taiwan Strait after an American warship sailed through the waters for the sixth time under the Biden administration. This routine operation was done in international waters in accordance with international law, said the 7th Fleet, which added the ship's transit through the Taiwan Strait demonstrates the U.S. commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific. The United States military flies, sails, and operates anywhere international water allows, the statement concluded. And then China's response was, the United States is up to its old trick of provoking troubles in the Taiwan Strait, deliberately undermining regional security and jeopardizing peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. China described the U.S. as the region's biggest risk creator. People Liberation Army, Navy, and Air Force assets in the area tracked and monitored U.S. warship throughout the journey. The Biden's administration's sanctioning of another 7th Fleet operation in the Strait follows a consistent pattern of U.S. military posturing in the waters around China, which has grown more assertive under the current president and underscored its intention to unify self-ruled Taiwan, if necessary, by force. Following U.S.-led communiques with European allies last week, China responded by renewing its nearly daily warplane activity near Taiwan in the span of 3 days between June 15th and June 17th. The People's Liberation Army dispatched 36 fighter jets, reconnaissance planes, and nuclear-capable bombers into Taiwan's defensive airspace. Taiwan's political status remains among China's most sensitive topics. It has warned the U.S. and its allies that Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Xinjiang are issues that brook no external challenges, and its growing military might is making its assertive pronouncements increasingly difficult to ignore. So, again, rumors of wars happening all around us with kind of some of the bigger countries that are, you know, capable of making or backing up their threats if they ever decided to. So it's interesting to see that stuff going on. Also, one of the things mentioned there is famines. Again, famines not necessarily being anything new in the country, but there is a lot of talk of worldwide famines in countries like the U.S. and such, where we really didn't have to worry about that stuff until recently because of COVID. This article recently done by the World Food Bank, in June 18th, it says an increasing number of countries are facing growing levels of acute food insecurity, reversing years of development gains. Even before COVID-19 reduced incomes and disrupted supply chains, chronic and acute hunger were on the rise due to various factors, including conflict, socioeconomic conditions, natural hazards, climate changes, and pests. COVID-19 impacts have led to severe and widespread increases in global food insecurity, affecting vulnerable households in almost every country, with impacts expected to continue through 2021 and into 2022. The Agricultural Commodity Price Index, or basically the prices for food, remained near its highest level since 2013, and as of June 15th, 2021, was approximately 35% higher than in January 2020. Cereal prices are 40% higher than January 2020. So if you want your Captain Crunch, you're going to pay money for it. The primary risks to food security are at the country level. Higher retail prices combined with reduced incomes mean more and more households are having to cut down on the quantity and quality of their food consumption. Numerous countries are experiencing high food price inflation at the retail level, reflecting lingering supply disruptions due to COVID-19, social distancing measures, currency devaluations, and other factors. Rising food prices have a greater impact on people in low and middle income countries, since they spend a larger share of their income on food than people in higher income countries. Though current food insecurity is by and large not driven by food shortages, supply disruptions and inflation of affecting key agricultural inputs such as fertilizer and seeds or prolonged labor shortages could diminish next season's crop. Also, the locust outbreak and further across the world, we've kind of touched on that in other prophecy updates, is further compounding this crisis across 23 countries. COVID-19 is estimated to have dramatically increased the number of people facing acute food insecurity in 2020 and 21. And the World Food Bank estimates that 272 million people are already at or at the risk of becoming acutely food insecure in the countries where it operates. Acute food insecurity is defined as when a person's life or livelihood is in immediate danger because of lack of food. So it's interesting from a worldwide perspective, just kind of just this anticipation of food shortages, which we've experienced some already in the United States that we're not used to. If you guys remember, I think the last one was like a beef shortage and prices kind of going sky high and people kind of hoarding beef and stuff for a while. So it's making it sound like we're going to continue to see kind of that trend. Interesting, you know, these things, we see these birth pains again increasing, these things, rumors of war, earthquakes, famines. The last thing I wanted to talk about was just this global economy. So Revelation 13, 16 through 17 tells us the Antichrist, he required everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to be given a mark on the right hand or on the forehead. And no one could buy or sell anything without the mark, which was either the name of the beast or the number representing its name. So you guys know Revelation, you know Bible prophecy, you're familiar with the mark of the beast. We've talked about this before, how the Antichrist, when he demands everyone to worship him, he's going to have this world government established where he's going to require everyone to take a mark, and you're not accidentally going to take it. It's going to be like you're knowingly worshiping him. And you get this mark, and it's going to allow you to, like, basically buy and sell food, to operate in the world's economy. So obviously, you know, a year ago, that would seem kind of pretty distant out there as far as, like, well, a lot of stuff would have to happen for something like that to be, to have the technology for it, or even for people to kind of buy into something like that. But a year later, it doesn't seem that far-fetched, because we see all these dominoes, you know, falling into place, if you will, or pieces falling into place that have expedited, like, the technology that would be needed for something like that, and man's willingness to basically kind of just accept something like that, do what they're told so that they can partake in the world's economy. One of those things is this talk of vaccine passports, or like having some type of mark or a digital passport on your phone or an app, whatever, that basically allows you to partake in kind of different things because you've had the vaccine, or you've already had COVID, or, you know, basically you're safe. You're safe, and you can partake with the rest of the world in doing things that anyone could do before. And of a European Union digital COVID certificate that's going to go into effect. Most of the countries are buying into it, if not all of them. Eventually, it's set to go into effect in July, where basically people are going to be able to get this app on their phone, and it's going to keep track of whether they've either had COVID before, or they've gotten the vaccine, or they've recovered, or they've got a negative test, whatever. It's going to track all that, and it's going to allow free movement between the different countries. The countries are going to recognize it and say, okay, you don't have to get tested. You can go about and live normally or whatnot. But again, it's like this tracking system that's going to allow them to partake freely in the economy. And so you see that already kind of going into place. Is that the mark of the beast? No, it's not the mark of the beast. Not at all. We know the specifics about the mark of the beast, but it's something like a preparation, if you will, or a conditioning that would have to happen before we ever get to that point. And you see that happening. Now, something else that would have to happen is in order for like to be to this global economy, you would have to see kind of the going away from independent dollars, if you will, or independent money in each country and kind of a global type money. And one of the first steps in getting there is going to digital currency, because obviously that's an easier thing to trade and move around and to unify, if you will. And what you see is this steady increase of countries kind of led by China with moving towards digital currency. The latest being, this is an article from a couple days ago, the Bank of Israel issues digital shekel, or basically the Bank of Israel has issued digital currency for a first internal pilot program prior to the possibility of issuing a digital shekel. So you see yet another country that's doing kind of a pilot program testing out this digital currency. And guess who's not that far away from it? This is an article from NBC on May 20th regarding the United States. It says the Federal Reserve will release a research paper this summer that explores a move to a central bank digital currency. The moves of multiple countries, most prominently China, in the central bank digital currency space has intensified talk about how aggressively the Fed should move. Fed officials have emphasized the importance of getting the issuance of a central bank digital currency right, rather than participating in a race with its global peers. However, the moves of multiple countries, most prominently China, in the central bank digital currency space has intensified talk about how aggressively the Fed should move. China's progress has stirred worries that it could undermine the dollar's position as a global reserve currency. So you see this rush all of a sudden to kind of move in that direction. Again, it making it way easier when we get to that point of there needing to be like a one world government with one currency that's controlled by them, to go with that route when you have a digital currency, a unified digital currency, and you see them kind of moving that way. So having said that, just to wrap this all up, because those are the things that I wanted to hit tonight, I want to kind of go back to Jesus's word in Matthew 24:6-8, where he says, and you will hear of wars and threats of wars, but don't panic. See, that's a key thing there. Don't panic, or don't be fearful. He actually mentions that in a couple places where he's talking about the events surrounding his return, to not be afraid, to not be fearful. And I think that's important, because you can hear some of this stuff and you can freak out, but the reality is the reason Jesus told us this, enough information to know that when we see these things and we recognize the season, that you don't have to freak out, because what you can be assured of is that everything is going according to my plan, all right? God's sovereign. He's in control. He's on a throne. Nothing is happening that he isn't allowing. And his plan, which we know for his people is great and awesome, is still going to happen. And so that's our hope. That's our assurance. When you see these things happening that you've been warned ahead of time that this is how it's going to go down, it should produce hope. It should produce an expectation. It should produce a sense of urgency. All good things, not bad things by any means. We're not to be afraid. The rest of the world's afraid because they don't know what the heck's going on. You know, they're fearful because they see these things and they think the world's about ready to end. And really it is. But for us, that's the best thing, because Jesus is coming back. Amen. And so we want to be like what Jesus says in Luke 21:28, where it says, so when all of these things begin to happen, all right, when you see these things happening, he says, stand and look up. Get caught up in those things. Get distracted by those things. Get fearful of those things. No, that's not what he says. He says, stand, or like I said in the beginning, be ready, be alert, you know, stand and get your focus on me. Make sure your focus is where it should be, you know, on heavenly mindedness, on things above, on God's word, on these promises I made you. You know what's going to happen. He said, focus on those things, for your salvation is near. Man, he's coming back. It's right around the corner. And as we see all these pieces starting to fall into place, it only should get us more excited for that and make us more focused on him in the mission he's given us. Remember, our mission never changes. As I've talked about all through the book of Acts, it was the same at the beginning of the church. It's the same right now. And that is to know Jesus and make him known to the rest of the world. We have a really simple mission. We look to him for help. We keep our focus on him as he leads us into those things he has us to be faithful in. And we follow him right into the next life, whether we go to him or he comes to get us. Amen? And that could be any day now, all right? And that's an exciting thing, okay? He's coming back in the clouds, so just keep looking up. And when you see clouds, it could be the day, all right? As my wife said, even on a blue day or blue sky day, he might just open up the whole sky and make clouds. So could be any moment. But glad you guys could join us tonight. If you guys are in your home groups with other people, there's a whole lot more that I could have talked about these things. And some of you guys might have more knowledge about kind of the current events. So talk about those things amongst yourself. And also talk about how it is an encouragement to us. Like in the midst of these things that are uncomfortable and hard going around us, how we have this encouragement, or we should encourage each other, remind each other if you're not encouraged, that we have this solid foundation in God's word of knowing what's going to happen and knowing that he's working all these things for our good, and it only gets better for us. And so we look forward to that, right? So God bless you guys. Have a great evening.